Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While the U.S. focuses on threats of ISIS, the future of Europe, and international terrorism, practically no one other than the Pentagon, the military itself, and military families are thinking about the continuing U.S. military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, which includes Oklahomans today, now 13 and 15 years since those conflicts began. My guest today says we should, and we as a country and people should take a long, hard look in the mirror about the cost in lives and families, and at the at best inconclusive results. John Cale Weston was a former State Department official and political advisor who spent seven consecutive years on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2003 to 2010. Not in the relative comfort of the Green Zone, but on the line with U.S. troops, mostly with U.S. Marines in Anbar Province, Fallujah, and Sadr City during the height of the insurgency in Iraq, and in Host and Helmand provinces in Afghanistan. His memoir of his time is unflinching, powerful, and indicting. It's titled The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Knopf. It's a tough read at times. He says there are no heroes in this story, save the men and women who gave their lives in the line of duty, which Weston lists throughout the book. But John Cale Weston was acknowledged by the State Department for his multi-year service in Fallujah with the Marines. It awarded him one of its highest honors, the Secretary of State's Medal for Heroism. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Cale Weston, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This book is aptly titled The Mirror Test, and I have to tell you, in many ways it's a tough read because for so many Americans, unless you are affiliated with a military family, these long conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have passed by, not always in the forefront of our thoughts. And this book really engages your readers to look at what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq through the first decade of this century. Why the title, The Mirror Test?
Well, thank you for focusing on the title. It's not your typical, I think, war book title. And publisher and I agreed that, you know, this book is a challenge. It's not an easy read, but the actual mirror test is a medical term that medical doctors apply to disfigured patients. And I focus on specifically a Marine I met in Fallujah a few months before. He was badly disfigured in a big roadside bomb. And he writes himself very eloquently about what it's like to finally have the courage or the stamina to look at your new appearance in the mirror. And I try and apply that through what is a very thick book to these two longest wars in our history.
Now, as a State Department official at the time of 9/11 and right after 9/11, you were at the UN mission in New York, correct?
I was.
And you were basically working with the international community to, I guess, freeze assets and the like at the UN?
Yeah, my job there, I worked a bit on Iraq, and there were kind of two tracks going on. We heard the drums of war beating in Washington, and our ambassador's job was to try and get the UN Security Council to support a tough resolution that included language on, you know, holding Iraq to account and, you know, the weapons of mass destruction program that some people were arguing were in Iraq. And then my job day-to-day was to try and get the international community, 15 government, to agree on the Al-Qaeda-Taliban sanctions list. So I had one foot in the Iraq room and one foot in the Al-Qaeda room.
Of course, you were probably present when Secretary of State Colin Powell was making the case for weapons of mass destruction. And that was really a policy in which you were perhaps not convinced.
I'm a fan of Colin Powell. I think I always will be, but I was not a believer that this was a necessary war. I spent a lot of time in New York talking to a lot of diplomats from around the world, and they had a lot of good questions about what seemed to be a rush to invade. So, yeah, I was there when Secretary Powell made his WMD, weapons of mass destruction, case to the world community, and especially, I think, to the American public.
I have to ask you, since you don't spend a lot of time focusing on this in the book, you spend time focusing on your time in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's it like when you, in your heart of hearts, you know that you don't support this policy, but your position as a State Department official is to support the policy?
Well, I signed up for a job where I salute and do the best I can, but I think, you know, it's a good question. It also forced me to think hard about what you're paid to do, what you're, in effect, told to do from your bosses, and maybe what your conscience or your own mind is telling you to do. I went to Iraq not because I believed in the war, but I did go to Iraq because I felt that's where I should be. But over the course of my time in Fallujah and the western part of Iraq, seeing the tremendous human cost of war and warfare, which is probably universal throughout all of our wars, I think it kind of called my own bluff that I decided I probably never could salute and serve in a wrong war again. But we need people who are good at that, because if we didn't have diplomats, then probably there would be a lot more war.
So once the war was completed, you, I guess, volunteered to go to Iraq?
Right. We had a small State Department contingent that were not really ordered. We all basically volunteered, because at that time the State Department was still getting used to what it was like to have its staff in a war zone. And so I went over there as about one of 50, and at the time, Ambassador Bremer, who led the Coalition Provisional Authority, in effect reported to Secretary Rumsfeld, and it was mainly a Department of Defense-run operation, given that we still had 150,000 troops on the ground.
Now, a lot of people have criticized the provisional government. It sounds like you tried to distance yourself from that. Your first assignment was working with Iraqi truck drivers.
Yeah, I didn't go in intentionally trying to find a job with the Teamsters of Iraq, but I boiled down my first year in Baghdad to this one chapter where I wanted to kind of humanize who are these Iraqis that didn't ask for the American invasion but got it and are still living with the repercussions, you know, 15 years later. So I was assigned to help make sure that the food got moved around the country while the insurgency was starting to pick up, and I learned a lot from these guys. I was kind of very much out of my element. I had left the suit and tie world of New York and showed up in Baghdad, sitting across many tables from some tough-looking characters who, let's just say, weren't used to having Americans in the room.
How did that experience sort of help inform what you would do later? It sounded like it was a great way to actually experience what Iraq was about.
Yeah, I went into Iraq naive, like our country did. But the longer I stayed there, I think a little bit wiser I got. And I quickly learned that when you leave the palace grounds with the swimming pool and the gates and the green lawns that are well watered in a very hot and dry country, that if you listen to the average people, and truckers, I think, in any country are probably going to be the best judge of what's really going on in their towns and communities, they tell you what you need to hear. So I shifted then from less of a focus on what the official Iraqi leaders were telling us and more to what the wisdom on the street could convey. And one character in particular named Bassam really taught me a lot.
In fact, at one point you invited those truckers to one of Saddam's palaces as a sort of, a goodwill gesture. And you said, immediately once I did this, I realized what a horrible mistake I was making, because it sort of reinforced every negative stereotype about Americans coming to Iraq among Iraqi people. You know, you had guys lounging by the pool, you know, eating food that probably wouldn't be seen ever on an Iraqi table.
Yeah, I think in the book I say that, you know, one of the truckers, actually one of the guys who worked with the trucker said, you know, when he entered the palace in the green zone, this is not Iraq. And I think he put it better than anyone by kind of boiling it down to what he was basically saying is, you know, this is where Saddam and our former dictator and his people lived, and now you guys are there. And when they walked in, they saw us living basically a life of leisure in the middle of a worsening war zone. And that was hard for me to digest, because I knew that I had made a mistake.
And living as occupiers, really.
Yeah, we were an official occupying power, so there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Under the UN resolution at the time, we went in as an occupying power, which gave us certain authorities, but also limited us in some ways. And I get into a little bit of that. I did not want this book to be a policy Washington type analysis book. I wanted it to be an introduction as best I could into who's most affected by these wars, and that starts out with the Iraqis.
And of course, what's also evident is that you were not a person that hung out in the green zone. You were on the ground, probably in some danger for most of those 7 years you were in Iraq and Afghanistan, working on the ground in El Anbar province and Fallujah at the time of the major Sunni uprising at that point. And you were being a person-to-person diplomat. It's very commendable. Did you volunteer to go to Fallujah?
I did. We needed political officers, State Department reps with the various military commands. But before I tell you about that transition, I should say that, you know, I don't believe the heroes in these wars usually come back alive. But there were plenty of brave people that I worked with, and I'll always put the Iraqis and the Afghans up front. But I did go west because I got to know some Marines who convinced me it was the place to go. And Ambassador Negropani, who was my boss at the time, you know, needed his guy out west with the Marine generals. And I thought, okay, we're between Fallujah 1, which was the first battle, and in April of 04, after the Blackwater contractors were dragged through the streets of Fallujah, and then the bigger battle, which commenced in November. So if you're in government work and policy work, at some level you want to be not only where you're going to be most needed, but where you'll have the longest leash. And I knew I would have a very long leash in Fallujah, because I used to think, well, what are they going to do? Send me to Fallujah, I'm already here.
In the course of telling this story, you get to know some really remarkably brave Iraqis, a lot of brave Marines. And you mentioned, you said the heroes are the ones that didn't come back. And one of the things your book points out, all along your journey, you're writing the names of the men and women who died in the line of duty, where they're from, you know, their hometowns, throughout the book. And that was a conscious effort on your part.
Thank you, and thank you for pointing that out. And I owe my publisher a lot for adding more pages when it would have been easy for Knopf to say no. I wanted the names to be more than just footnotes, and I think in these wars, unfortunately, it has become easy for us to feel bad at one level, but to not really know anything more about them than just name and age and maybe the hometown. So I wanted to bring to life, and actually I think the word I try and use is resurrect, as much as I can, some of these people who really did pay the highest price. That's a lot of Marines, a lot of soldiers, and also the Iraqi and the Afghans who worked with us. So those lists that I included who were killed 93 and 91, I think are probably some of the most important pages, and some of the most rewarding reactions I'm getting from the book are from average readers across America who say, thank you, I never realized how young, or from which places, you know, these Marines come from. And when you think about KIA, killed in action or lost, it's a family that feels the pain, but often it's a whole hometown. And I know in Oklahoma there are quite a few as well.
And one of the things that shows up is also an awful lot of lance corporals. That would be one of the most dangerous ranks around.
Yeah, for much of the Iraq War, Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, KIA, was the most common headline when a tragedy happened. And I think that still holds true when we go to war. The first wave in are our Marines and some soldiers, but usually the grunts, who proudly call themselves grunts. But I guess another big frame of the book is to try and step back a bit and think about at least some of the questions. I don't have all the answers, but I try and pose the question, is the policy going to match the sacrifice? Because when the United States of America goes to war, there will automatically be huge sacrifice. There will be sacrifice on our side, but also among those people who stand up and choose to work with us. And I have some stories of the Iraqis and the Afghans who fit that category as well.
One of the things you did, you're right there in the center of town through a good part of that time in Fallujah, outside of the very protected fire bases, and really taking risk along with a lot of Marines. And you talk about their esprit towards the mission of trying to do right, of trying to be protective, also at times engaged in the humanitarian mission of Fallujah. But you also, while there that esprit was high, You're getting questions all the time. Is this going to be worth it? How did you answer those questions at the time?
I never had a good or a quick answer, and I'm not sure I do now, a decade later. The esprit de corps of the Marine Corps is an amazing thing to withhold in person, and I think most of my Marine friends would say we fought for the Marine to my left and to my right, and I think there's a lot of truth and validation in that. But as far as how I answered, and I got the questions from commanding generals to colonels to the corporals, was some mixture of, you know, we're here, our country kind of sent us here, or in my case, I volunteered to be here, and we'll do the best we can to make a very bad situation better. And a lot of their questions increasingly focused on the elections and the political process, because they knew that, you know, there was a limitless supply of bullets that could be shot in both directions. And if the ballots and the election process didn't create a more stable Iraq, that type of fight would never end. But I didn't have a good answer, because I don't think the policy ever matched the sacrifice.
My guest today is Gil Weston. He was a State Department official who served on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan from the years 2003 to 2010. He's the author of the book, The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a really tremendous story of you're trying to accomplish rebuilding after the conflict. The hot conflict was over in Fallujah. Meanwhile, you had an insurgency coming up, and you're still trying to do good work. At the same time, this insurgency makes your job almost impossible. I want to ask about what you call the 31 angels. And this is a very sad part of the book. The pressure's on to have an election, to have Sunni participation in the election, even though the Sunnis are talking about this is the famous election with the purple thumbs that everybody remembers. And your position was, even though the Sunnis were not likely to participate, they had to have poll stations open throughout the province so people could vote, so that the Sunnis could have at least the representatives they deserve in the new national government. And this resulted in tragedy just a couple nights before the election. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and I struggled with whether or not to actually even include this in the book. I ended up doing it, I hope, for the right reasons, because I wanted to hold myself accountable but not overly dramatize a decision that had to be made one way or another. But we were charged with trying to figure out, as you kind of previewed, how to support the first Iraqi election after the biggest battle of the Iraq War, which was the Fallujah 2 battle in November, December of 04. And part of the talking points out of Washington at the time, well, we're not here to just kill terrorists. We're here to, you know, allow the Iraqis that opportunity to vote. And so we had about 35, give or take, 1,000 troops in western Iraq, and the generals and I were trying to figure out what that strategy would be to enable those Iraqis to vote. And there were two options. One was to focus just on the population centers of Fallujah and Ramadi, and the other option that I favored was to send Marines into remote areas so that a handful or dozens of Iraqis may vote. And I had been told they were going to boycott. But I think at that stage, I was still believing the propaganda in my own mind, and probably the propaganda coming out of our government about what this election process may lead to, which would be a government that was unified, that included the Sunni Arab population. I also knew that Marines would do a damn good job of protecting these polling sites, and that if you're a Sunni politician, and the next day you wake up and your tribe hasn't been given the opportunity to vote, if you have enough of those instances, then the whole election process would fall apart. The tragedy, as you state, happened when two big Marine helicopters were flying west. One crashed full of Marines who had basically volunteered to help with this mission for election support, and 31 service members were killed, 30 Marines and a corpsman, and that is the single largest casualty incident of both wars. I put that in the book to get to another theme, which is accountability. I mean, I could walk the accountability all the way back to how this war kicked off, how our leadership opted to go to war after 9/11 in Iraq, not just in Afghanistan. But I also think it's important that those of us on the ground also reflect and reckon with our roles and I do my best to try and humanize these 31 angels, because I didn't want them to just be lost into the pages of, you know, a footnote in some book. I wanted to try and, yeah, resurrect them a little bit.
You talk about accountability, and one of the themes that comes through the book is how, one, unaccountable, how uninquisitive Washington was about how things were actually going in Iraq. There were outliers. There were officials that did take a serious view of what was happening. But for the most part, Washington wanted to make a pronouncement and move on.
Yeah, I didn't want this to be a drive-by tell-all, a book that would kind of diminish what these bigger questions are. But I did want it to be a book that was blunt about that disconnect between how war decisions are made in our capital by our elected leaders, and then how we try and implement or unscrew some of those decisions on the ground. I name names when I need to, because I believe if you're the Secretary of Defense or the Vice President or the President, either administration, either party, that this is the most important endeavor you undertake as our leader, in your role as Commander-in-Chief. And I did have insights into those policy ground-level disconnects that I feel like Americans over time may want to know a bit more about. And that was really kind of the genesis and the motivation behind the book, that I sat in a lot of rooms over 7 years, and I'm trying to pull back some of those curtains, not to, again, take any cheap shots, but to show the reader, you as citizens, when you vote for Commander-in-Chief or you vote in an election, are, I think, taking on the most important role we have, which is, who is that person that's going to lead 2.5 million service members in a time of war that goes on and on and on.
And the first half of the book is about your time in Iraq, the second half about Afghanistan. And from the first reading of the part of Afghanistan, it says one of the first things you were asked once they found out you were from the State Department, they ask about, or they would tell you about, a man named Dilawar. Mm-hmm. Who was Dilawar?
Dilawar was an Afghan who lived in Host Province, which is where I went for almost a year and a half, which is on the easternmost edge of Afghanistan along the Pakistan border. And his story actually started and ended before I arrived, but he still remained a flashpoint. And he's another picture in the book, actually, and another story in the book that motivated all 600 pages. And his is, I think, an attempt by me to describe what the effects of enhanced interrogation or torture are on the ground. And some good work was done by various journalists, including the New York Times, a couple of years even before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke in Iraq. But I spend a chapter on him, trying to just, again, bring him back from the dead, because I think his story is worth knowing. And when we talk about torture and enhanced interrogation, I think it becomes this very dry, very politicized, and very hot-button issue. But when you understand his story, I think it brings it to a level that we should think hard about, because the policies in Washington and a lot of legal memos between high-level administration officials do translate into how we conduct ourselves on the ground. And I think if there's one photo in the book and there's one story in the book also that motivated all 42 chapters, it's his story. He was killed in one of our detention facilities in Afghanistan. A taxi driver who got rounded up, it seems very much by mistake, and within 5 days he was dead.
You also write in the Iraqi section of another sort of small fire that you had to put out. Well, it wasn't a small fire at the time, it was this huge fire, named Sarah Al-Jawari, I believe. I may be getting the last name wrong, but this was a Delta Force team that came and swooped her off the streets, and these imams that you were working with and various leaders in Fallujah, they had worked with you in really a lot of ways in which most Americans, if they read this book, had no idea of the collaboration for a lot of these people. And they were telling you, you need to get her back or this is going to blow up.
Right. And like Dilawar's story, Sarah's story with the last Grand Mufti of Fallujah, their stories are tied together in Iraq. again, motivated this four-year writing process, because while I know that our Delta Force and SEALs have a hugely important role to undertake in a war zone, I also had experiences and I have information and knowledge that sometimes they make mistakes too, and they can sometimes make strategic mistakes that end up costing us a lot, and especially the Iraqis. And the short of that story is that we had Zarqawi, who was the number one al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, who used to be in Fallujah and used to spend most of his time in western Iraq helping direct car bombs into the capital. So I know why he was such an important target, and I know why he needed to be killed. At the same time, we were building those relationships, collaborating with the Iraqi leaders, as you mentioned, including the primary religious leader in the city of mosques, which is what Fallujah is known in his name. It was one that I definitely wanted in the book, is Sheikh Hamza. And he helped us basically settle down the city, even during and after the biggest battle of the Iraq War. When she was detained twice in 2 weeks by the Delta team, he basically one-on-one said to me, "You're putting me in danger, because the al-Qaeda guys, including Zarqawi, who was still alive at the time, were intimidating him. They wanted him to rile up the city. And he could have very easily turned on every mosque in that city to be anti-American, which would have cost a lot of Marines their lives and their limbs. But instead, he said, I'm going to try and quiet them down." When she was detained the second time, we got her out, and I write about how we did that. But not long after, he was assassinated. And when the ambassador asked me who killed Sheikh Hamza, I said, "We did." And while we did not put the bullets into his chest, it's an example of where well-meaning Americans, and we all were well-meaning, did not do right by our Iraqi partners.
Well, what I really appreciated about the book was how you described so many Marines. You mainly served with Marines, and also you. You went out and met the people of Iraq and Afghanistan in their own locales. You sat down, you broke bread with them, you tried to understand them, and I think that certainly needed to happen a lot more in both of those countries.
I did spend a lot of time with a lot of Marines, you know, in a lot of their compounds, drinking a lot of tea, eating a lot of raisins, and listening more than we talked through interpreters. But until the Iraqi and the Afghans write their books about us, which I think will be the ultimate mirror test, when they put in their own words what it was like to have the Americans show up doing some good and sometimes doing some bad, my book, I hope, is a step in that direction to give voice and to give some due to their side of the story, because I don't fault the first wave of books that came out of these wars, but a lot of it was us and our own heroics, or us and our own experience through American eyes and voices. And then at a later shift, you know, got to sort of, well, we had interpreters that worked with us. I hope my book kind of closes that gap even a little bit more, which is, here are some of the Iraqis and the Afghans I hope that will stick with you after you finish the book. And then one day I hope we're all reading more Iraqi and Afghan accounts, because they will be the most credible in holding us to account. And they'll say, "This worked. We're glad the Americans did this. This is where the Americans screwed up. This is where, you know, we learned as well." Because, you know, they made mistakes too. They made decisions also that translated into things that didn't work out so well. But until we get their voices unfiltered, I hope the mirror test, this book helps close that gap.
Cale Weston, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
John Cale Weston is a former State Department official who spent 7 years on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, 2003 to 2010. His new book is titled The Mirror Test, America at War in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.